Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey, welcome to another great episode of the NIDS View. I am Curtis McGiffin, and I am with you today with Jim Klingmeier as my guest. Adam and Jim Petrosky are on vacation and enjoying themselves. One of these days, I'll get a chance to go on vacation. But never. But apparently, I keep drawing the short straw, and I have to hold the fort down. But that's okay. They missed out on what is going to be a great topic today, which we'll get to in a few minutes. But I want to welcome you, Jim. Thanks again. I know you were on with us here a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
But a lot has happened, and I just want to have you just sort of remind our listeners who you are, your background, and what tickles your fancy these days.
Yeah. Other than, you know, we've known each other for 30 years, all right?
So right.
We both grew up in the Air Force together. So I was an intel guy in the Air Force, retired out, right. Started a nonprofit, the Lafayette Group. Along with some other entities. And so we do hostage recovery in the Middle East, particularly Syria, Iraq, and also North Africa. So we've been in and out since 2018. A lot going on in the last few weeks, I'm sure, you know, your viewers have seen on the news. But still no resolution as far as finding folks.
Right. Jim, as the Trump administration's sort of recognition of the Syrian government and here recently in the last couple of weeks, has that changed your ability to do your great work with this hostage?
You know, it's made it a lot easier. You know, before the recognition, when the leadership of Syria was on the bad boy list, you know, I would have had to go through justice and treasury in order to get permissions to wire money into Syria and to employ Syrians in the capacity for looking for Americans who were perished in Syria. Now that's gone. I don't have to worry about having that to get those permission slips in order to do the work. So my guys have still, you know, primarily they're Kurdish, but now I can branch out and employ Syrians as well, and they're happy to do it. Still looking for unfortunately for the remains for Cale Mueller, Steve Sotloff, Peter Kasich, James Foley. There was a Jesuit priest, a Mallory woman, and a handful of other Westerners who were all perished in Syria at the hands of ISIS. And I think, you know, it looks more and more, I mean, folks are looking for Austin Tice. That was the big to-do. Yeah. I was in there, I think, in December or January when the country fell. And, you know, there was quite a push to find Austin Tice, and I think they're still looking. I think a lot of folks have resolution. I think it's come out in the press that he was he's perished. He was executed, they believe, years ago. This wasn't anything that happened recently. But again, when it comes to recovery, that's what we do, right? So the FBI, right, through the and conjunction with the SPEHA, Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs, does the negotiation for hostages or illegally detained Americans in the West. There's a number of organizations. There's the Sufan Group out of New York. There's the Global Reach Group out of here in the D.C. area, who they primarily are looking for folks who are being held in captivity. What Lafayette Group does on behalf of the families, we bring home those who perished at the hands of their captors.
Right.
And so it's made it infinitely easier now to go in. It's still the wild, wild west. It's still not a safe place to go to. So we'll be going here in about another month. Next month, after 4th of July weekend, we'll go back in and work with our partners there. It's been a long, long push, but it's good news for us to be able to go in Syria without having to look over our shoulder and worry about crossing some line with respect to U.S. policy. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Now we just have to take into consideration the threats that are there.
Yeah, those don't seem to go away, but at least maybe it's a little bit easier for you to bring some closure to these families who have lost loved ones and are eager to place them in their final resting. Yep.
That's the hope. That's the plan.
Opportunities. Well, it's great that you're still doing that. I'm glad that the Trump administration has sort of eased things in Syria. And of course, things have maybe settled a little bit in Syria, and
you know,
maybe that'll
help you. My guys are telling me that the leadership over there, you know, it's you know, folks. A lot of folks say, well, they're still terrorists, right? We fought them, but the precedent was set. I mean, you look at World War II. We are allies with those two countries. We fought a war, with. Mm-hmm. And so, precedent's been set, and they're doing all the right things. The concern is, how can we help them reach that capacity in a short amount of time so that they don't implode and become yet another failed state? No one wants it, right?
No.
And so that's the other thing we're working on and trying to establish those ties with the Syrian government as well.
Well, good. Well, we wish you the best of luck in all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so thanks again for sharing that. Well, for our listeners, we don't normally talk about when we do these recordings, but particularly we're going to. So we're actually recording this on the 4th of June. It's a week later. So we're going to talk about the Ukrainian drone attack on. On Russia and its strategic forces. An organization like the National Institute for Deterrent Studies, we would be quite remiss if we didn't bring up this topic and at least give listeners some thoughts on this. And so I think it's going to be great to hear your perspective on this from an intel background and your familiarity with this topic. But so let me just sort of give us a little introduction. So as of the 4th of June, because this is probably a story that is probably changed some by the time this is this podcast is released to our listeners. But again, just to remind us, on June 1st, which is a Sunday, Ukraine executed a significant and unprecedented drone assault deep within Russian territory, targeting multiple strategic bases. The operation, known as Spiderweb, was orchestrated by Ukraine's security services, or the SBU, and involved the deployment of 117 drones aimed at crippling Russia's long-range aviation capabilities. Now, this is an audacious attack, right? That some are calling Russia's Pearl Harbor, which ironically was on a Sunday as well. The drone struck five key air bases, including one located deep in Siberia. I think, Jim, they crossed like five time zones. Which housed a significant portion of Russia's strategic air assets, including the Tu-95 Bear bomber and the Tu-22 M3 medium jet bomber, as well as the A-50U, which is their airborne early warning aircraft. Kind of looks like our AWACS, got a big dish on top. And Ukrainian officials report that the attack resulted in the destruction or damage of 41 military aircraft, significantly impacting their strategic bomber fleet. Today, on the 4th of June, the Moscow Times is reporting that Ukraine's military managed to damage over 40 Russian aircraft, estimating 10 to 13 of them totally destroyed, including at least one A-50 reconnaissance. They call it a reconnaissance aircraft. I think they only have five or six of these things, of which maybe three were available at the time. Yeah. They may have next to none now. And some estimates say that this the damage and destruction is about $7 billion in aircraft and infrastructure. And the Russians, as of this day, are reporting no casualties. So they were apparently successful in not killing anyone either. The operation showcased Ukraine's innovative tactics with drones reportedly smuggled into Russia, concealed within shipping containers, and launched from trucks positioned near the targeted air bases. I believe these trucks were parked like within a couple kilometers of these bases.
I think they had one where they showed it just on the other side of the fence line.
Yeah, quite literally. This approach allowed Ukrainian forces to bypass traditional air defenses with minimal to no warning to deliver a substantial blow to Russian Air Force, its leadership, and quite frankly, to embarrass President Putin himself. In response to the attack, Russian President Putin spoke with President Trump, I think it was yesterday, expressing his intention to retaliate against Ukraine. Despite ongoing diplomatic efforts, including peace talks in Istanbul, the situation remains tense and both sides are preparing for likely retaliations and subsequent escalations. Operation Spiderweb represents a significant escalation in the conflict, demonstrating Ukraine's capacity to conduct deep strikes into Russian territory and challenging perceived security of the Russian strategic assets. I would go to say that this challenges the idea that there are still safe havens in this world, that no matter if you go deep into your homeland, that you'll somehow be safe. I think this all but eliminates that idea. It's important to note a couple of things. In some of my research today, I learned that the Ukrainians produce 5 million drones a year. They are the largest drone producer in the world. And everything from the little quadcopters, you know, all the way to much bigger ones. And that when they launched this attack, none of the Ukrainians were in Russia. They launched them all from Ukraine, each having their own first-person view control of a specific quadcopter that carried the munitions, and they guided them over the cellular network within Russia. So this is quite interesting and innovative, right? So it was much more immune to jamming. There's some speculation that they used fiber optics, which kind of makes me think that that's why they called it Operation Spiderweb. There's video footage in the fields of Ukraine, where soldiers will walk out and they're covered in these white things that look like spider webs, but it's the fiber optic lines attached to many of these to these UAVs, and so it looks like there's spider webbing all over the grass. And so, anywho, when you're connected to a fiber optic, then you're not really going to be affected by any jamming or electronic countermeasures and these sorts of things. So these are just a couple things. So the first question I want to ask you, Jim, is you give your reaction to this, and I think this will help. But let me ask you, how might the success of this attack shape the war in Ukraine moving forward and its prospects for peace?
First of all, I just need to give a shout out to the Ukrainians. I thought it was phenomenal. I mean, they didn't have a bigger cheerleader here than me. I thought they did a great job. I think fortunately, they've done this before, and I think they will be able to do it again. So, just when you think they're down, don't discount them, because they seem to pop back up. Tactically, I think that was probably a win. I mean, from a informational perspective, a psychological perspective, whatever you want to call it, I think it's a big win. Yeah. I think it for their folks at home can feel a little proud. The guys on the line can feel pretty good. And probably ask the question, and so what? You took out these bombers. How is that going to help me in this trench? And I think a large part of it, honestly, I think, was to send a message to Europe, not so much the U.S. There's a debate whether we even knew about it, whether it was going on. I think we probably did to a certain degree. But I think it was more of a sending a signal to the European Union saying, look, we need your help because we are able, when we have this capacity to do strikes, to put Russia on their heels. Unfortunately, I think that the Russian population is so enamored and locked in with Putin and his mindset and his optic and his narrative of why they're in this special military operation. Mm-hmm. And I think by him telling President Trump that, hey, we're going to have a retaliatory strike, it's going to hurt. I mean, not to sound flippant, because, these are Ukrainians who are going to perish, but it's going to hurt. But again, I think the Ukrainian military, SBU, hats off to them. I think they did a great job. I think they just need to do it more. And I think I'm not sure, honestly. I mean, we talk about the strategic aviation, being the target. So maybe there was some sort of indication that those bombers were going to be used in an attack against Ukraine. I don't know. But I would have thought that there would have been maybe better targets, you know, that would have a more of an effect on mm-hmm. where the battle lines are. You know, this trench warfare is, you know, early 20th century, but I'm not sure if knocking out these bombers is going to have an effect on a private sergeant lieutenant trying to win 100 yards or even 50 yards on the line.
Yeah, I think you're right. In this sense, I think the goal was to take out these bombers because they were primarily the shooters of these cruise missiles yeah. and hypersonic missiles that are being yeah. aimed at the cities and the infrastructure. So I'm right. I think you're right. It's not going to help the private and the sergeant that are in the trenches of eastern Ukraine. But I would say that it was definitely a way to sort of relieve some pressure on the cities. As typical when nations are sort of ramping up for peace talks, the fighting tends to get a little more intense because they're sort of trying to get the last bit of land before, the chalk line is drawn in any sort of peace deal. But I think my take is maybe a little bit different than you. I don't disagree the wow, it's an incredible. Yeah. I mean, this rivals, you know, the Israeli, you know, beeper, you know, killings, yep, if yep, you will, yep. of all the Hezbollah leadership and the innovativeness of how they've been able to, you know, think these things up and then execute using the organic comm lines and trucking mechanisms and all these sorts of things. They just sort of blend it in as best they could. Now, you know, many Ukrainians speak Russian. They look Russian. It's probably pretty easy for them to infiltrate
sure.
And do those sorts of things. I'm not downplaying the value of this. I'm just saying that this is bears a lot of scrutiny. Now, I think what really bothers me is that specifically the Tu-95s, these are part of Russia's strategic triad. These are nuclear capable bombers. And Russian doctrine this talks about the idea if you attack Russian nuclear assets that in their mindset, what Ukraine has done could very well, in their mindset, justify a nuclear retaliation. If you read the doctrine, now, all sure. of the Westerners like you and I, you know, will look at this and go, well, that's totally unreasonable.
Right.
But if you're a Russian who has endured this kind of attack and it has destroyed what some are arguing are 20 to 30% of their strategic aviation assets, that is a real problem. These are airplanes that cannot be replaced. That is a big degrade. Even when this war is over, that is a degrade that will still exist. And this is problematic for them. Imagine if we lost 20% of our B-52s. How would we react right. to that? And so I think it might be good that we didn't know anything about this attack from a diplomatic. This gives President Trump some plausible movement, right? Some, I don't want to say plausible deniability in a sense. I'm saying it just, he probably was not made aware of this, whether the Biden administration knew that they say there was this was 18 months in planning. So someone knew about this.
Right.
And certainly when Zelensky was showed up to the White House and sat in the Oval, not in the Oval Office, but sat in that, you know, in that meeting that we all watched on TV where Zelensky was basically sent on his way, he knew this was going to happen. He knew this was going to happen, and my guess is that if this is embarrassing to the Trump administration, Zelensky's probably pretty satisfied with that. But nonetheless, the reality here is that I think this has made peace negotiations much more difficult and much farther in the distance. We in the world can look forward to more bloodshed in the Ukraine theater,
yep.
more possibility of a nuclear detonation, not less. And all you've done is enraged Putin, who will find another way to exact some sort of revenge and try to garner back some of his political wasta in that sense. And so I think... like you said, Jim, this was a battle, a victory for the day, and they can be proud of it. But a week or two or three from now, when Ruzbek missiles are falling on the, conventionally armed or not, will wonder if that was really worth it. And I hate to be so pessimistic, but I am. My reputation on this show is that I am the pessimist. So
say it isn't so.
I know. So let's go ahead, and then we'll move on to the next question.
On the reaction of Russia, you know, from a scaling perspective, I think by us, as you point out, us, the U.S., not knowing or not being complicit to this, I think if we were or if we had pushed them to do so or if we had armed them to do so, then it would be a totally different conversation. And I think we would be concerned. Having said that, I don't think there was. And I think, I think the Ukrainians, good on them for what they did. And I think that, honestly, I know I differ with a lot of people about these peace negotiations. I don't think there is really a peace negotiation going on. I think it's just a stalling tactic on Putin, and I think he's going to try to choke him out and put a chokehold on Ukraine and wait for him to just wither and die. And I think that Zelensky, by doing what he did with the strike, and there was also the strike on the bridge in Crimea.
Yes.
Which I'm not sure if it was a successful strike. I mean, I know it was, but the strike itself was successful. I'm not sure if it brought down the bridge or rendered it, inoperative. But regardless, it shows an amount of bravado that the Russians don't. That the Russians certainly don't have. The Russians do not possess this mindset of throwing Hail Marys and trying to end this. They're perfectly happy with grinding it out and waiting through this war of attrition. So I think Zelensky did it because he wanted to sell that, hey, Ukraine's still here, we're not going anywhere, we're open for business, and we're gonna mix it up. We may take a loss here on some payback from Putin, but I think that I think we're naive to trust this guy Putin. I wouldn't believe a word. It sounds crass, and for your listening audience, but he's a Russian, and a Russian's lying, his lips are moving.
That's right.
I mean, the Russians respect one thing, and it's power and strength. They are not. You and I have both sat across from them, and they do not respect you when we're trying to. When we go up and we say, "Well, we need to have these peace negotiations," I think it's naive hope that we have, and I think we just need to kind of just say, enough, again, we should be supporting, personal opinion of Jim, we should be supporting Ukraine greater than we are today. If we're killing Russians via Ukrainians, I'd rather them do it than have an American kid have to do it.
Yeah, well, there are definitely different perspectives on this,
I'm sure you'll get some hate mail on that. So,
nah, it's okay. That's all right. We'll send it to you. Okay. So let's move on to the next question, which is: how will the success of this attack change the character of war, not only in that theater but maybe writ large? Does this bring a whole new threat or risk when it comes to drone warfare?
Yeah, you look at, drone warfare before, I think it was ISIS that started this. ISIS started this with drones and dropping grenades on coalition forces inside Syria. And it was their way of seeing and basically putting the full stop. They just didn't have the numbers. But they started, and I think it opened up this Pandora's box that we see now. The concern that I have is, and I think you may have it as well, is so they have shown the capacity to use drones at a level of lethality from a distance that was unheard of before this weekend. Mm-hmm. And so I live in Virginia, and just a few, an hour and a half south of here is Langley Air Force Base and, Norfolk, the Atlantic Fleet. And if you're viewers remember several months ago, they could not pin down why all these drones, who they belonged to. We've never heard an answer to it on who they were. Some said they're legit, they had FAA licenses to fly, some were military. Whatever it was, initially there were some drones flying down here, and there's no way for Langley or anyone else to have a geofence, if you will, to be able to shut these things down, especially, like you said, if they have the fiber optic wire. Mm-hmm. So it has opened up here in Northern Virginia, you can't fly drones, right? You can't fly drones, but you could. You could. You could just jailbreak them and you can fly them.
You can't.
You're going to legally fly them. You're going to go to
jail
if someone catches you. But the thing is, it's opened up this Pandora's box. When I look at the Pacific, you know, I served most of my career in the Pacific. When I look at Anderson Air Force Base in Guam, you know, we've got Marines in Australia. We're going to put more troops back in the PI in the Philippines. We're already in Japan, Korea. And then you look at operational plans, not to talk about operational plan specifics, but, you know, you look at the defense of Taiwan. You know, people forget, you know, we have an obligation to support them, right? And, you know, this drone has opened up my concern is all it's going to take is one bad day. You know, not even to the level that the Russians suffered losses. And I think, you know, folks in the U.S. will say, let's step back.
That's the goal.
That's the, yeah.
That is the goal, is to make us not want to fight.
Yep.
I just see, clearly Ukraine is, there's no country in the world, including Russia, or China, that can conduct drone warfare like Ukraine.
Right.
You know, there have been some thoughts about, you know, the drone warfare has created sort of a virtual trench warfare. You know, when you look on the battlefield and the soldiers, they can't get out of the trenches. They can't get out of their hidey holes for fear that they will get
popped,
assassinated by an individual first person FPV drone. These things have become, dare I say, terror weapons, in the sense that they'll chase you around, they'll harass you, they're literally, you know, they have a mind of their own, not the machine,
right,
but the controller, right?
Right,
the human, who could choose to accept your surrender. We've seen issues, you know, video where people will, Russians will surrender to these things and then follow them to the Ukrainian line, and then they surrender to a human, and these sorts of things, or they just sort of fly right at you and you know, blow half your body up with a hand grenade. Sorry to be so descriptive, but the point here is that as AI becomes introduced, and you have AI controlling drones, now you remove the human. And now you see how AI can then control these drones to specific targets, talking about, you know, looking for specific bio leads, whether or not you put a nuclear weapon on them or a small nuclear weapon on them.
Or just a threat of something.
Or even just a threat of these things, the latent capability and sort of thing, it becomes a real problem. And we're talking about a real asymmetric issue. These drones that were launched against Russia ranged between $600 and $1,000 a piece. They were destroying multi-million-dollar aircraft.
Irreplaceable aircraft.
The ROI on that is incredible. And what do? You're going to shoot million-dollar surface-to-air missiles at, you know, at a $600 drone that's so small you can't even hit it with a shotgun?
Right.
I mean, it is just – this is a real challenge. And so I think this leads us to our third question, Jim, which is how vulnerable are U.S. bombers – to such attacks from infiltrators, saboteurs, or combatants right here in the United States, whether it be in peacetime or wartime?
I would say extremely, extremely vulnerable. I mean, you look at the drones that were flying down in Norfolk and Langley Air Force Base, and no one ever really came with an answer for that. You know, this is the centralized control, decentralized execution. You mm-hmm. could put a group of folks here in the U.S., you know, whatever nationality, and have them have these same type of, you know, drones. And the repercussions would be huge, huge. You know, and folks up on the Hill would want a pound of flesh. They'd want some answers. Hearings would happen. PowerPoint slides would flow. And a lot of finger pointing. And at the end of the day, you know, we're going to have to come up with a better solution than having, you know, policy papers on reacting to these things. You know, what I envision is at some point in Asia, there's going to be a MEZ, military engagement zone, of where aircraft cannot go, right? Mm-hmm. It's just going to be drone only in this area. And so, You know, you hope to push that back. You hope, you know, however that works. But fighters, bombers, you know, manned aircraft, I should say, will not be going into that area. The problem is if they can push that MEZ out far enough, right, to the 12 con line, you know, where the Chinese views everything inside that line and belongs to China or mm-hmm. Russia or North Korea or Iran or whomever. You know, folks who don't have the budget that we do are getting smart, and they're coming up with ways to make our life interesting, maybe difficult. And I would hope that the folks at Boeing, Lockheed, Martin, the rest of them are listening and coming up with low-cost solution, because quantity is a quality of its own.
And that is absolutely right. Well, so I agree, and I think there, ironically, there was a big study out of the Hudson Institute that came out in January of this year, right before the inauguration, that was focused on the Indo-Pacific and the lack of hardened aircraft shelters for U.S. forces.
See?
And so there's a real concern about this. The study, I think, has taken on a new life, a new meaning after June 1st. And I would encourage folks, you know, maybe to take a look at it, and think about, you know, what are some of the real challenges, some of the costs here. You're talking about, so the average cost for a hardened shelter somewhere in the $4 to $6 million per shelter for a jet for a fighter aircraft size jet, right? So if you wanted to build one for a B-52,
right,
which all sit on the open ramps right yep. now around the, you know, in the appropriate bases around the country,
yep.
You would presume it would probably be a lot more expensive. But even if that was equated maybe to $20 million for a hardened shelter, you know, you're talking about, you know, I mean, well, you can't replace a B-52, but a B-21 is upwards of $800 million. So if you spend $20 million to put it in a hardened shelter, you know, there's probably, that is, if you will, drone-proof, you're probably going to get a good return on investment in that sense. It's a necessity. You may have to add it to the cost of the aircraft, right, which is, okay, we build one aircraft, means we've got to build one shelter. And they're all going to have to be covered in that regard. You can't rely on EW jamming.
Nope.
Because of the fiber optics and the cellular. You're going to shut off cell phone coverage on every military base. I mean, I don't know how you do that in this day and age. Kinetic responses, you can counter UAS systems, you know, which some of them are talking about directed energy weapons, you know, shoot a little laser beam at them, you know, and these sorts of things. You know, shotguns.
That's going to be tough. That's going to be tough.
You know, it's all tough, right? But you know what? We're going to build a golden dome to try to shoot missiles with missiles. You know, maybe
right.
we can build, you know, little mesh domes that shoot, you know, drones with you know, large caliber shotguns or something. But I think the best thing is the non-kinetic opportunities here. Better camouflage, dispersal of these aircraft. Maybe they need to be at more bases so that you've got to get out and target more places.
Yep.
Every time there's more, you know, you would think that, you know, for Ukraine to target five bases, that they would have been caught. You know, somebody would have caught them at, you know, with one of the five, versus if they just had one base that they were going to attack, you know, the chances of getting caught, it's either an all or none.
Right.
In that sense. I think one of hardened shelters, as we just discussed, netting systems, I think, seem to be maybe something that is probably the best. You know, creating, you know, we've shown we can do this, right? If you go to one of these golfing places. What do you call those places?
Yeah. Top off golf.
Right?
Golf.
They've shown you what a tall net can do,
right?
to keep the golf balls in.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is build that kind of netting around bases to keep the UAVs out. So and the drones out. So there might be some promise there. And of course, when you build shelters, hanging, there's talk already about drone nets at the Langley. Hangars that they have out there, that as you described. So these are definitely, I think, some big problems. Any comment on any of that?
You know, when we were young lieutenants, I remember that they had this thing. I forget who the chief was. Said every airman's a weapon system. Everyone's
yes.
a weapon system.
Right.
And so now I look at that and I think everyone really is a weapon system. You can have a decentralized soldier out there or whomever, mm-hmm. someone you pay who's a civilian living in the U.S. and has a drone, and he or she gets to choose their target, get the time and the place of their choosing, and it's going to be extremely, extremely hard. I think Intel is going to have to get really smart really quick, mm-hmm. and that's across the board, both HUMIT, SIGINT, and start figuring this out. Right. I don't disagree that hardening Air Force bases, we need to, but at the same time, if push comes to shove, we're probably going to have to disperse those aircraft, right? And we're going to have a lot more friends around the world allowing us to park a B-52 temporarily at their international airport so it can refuel and reman or whatever and then take off again. Because if these things are sitting on the tarmac, remember, you have that single-person weapon system out there who's going to create, chaos. So.
That's right. Well, we definitely have a challenge here. I think the Air Force might be a little bit behind in preparing for this. Intel is a big deal, but also reacting to that intel. Actionable intel means you got to act.
Right.
And if you got suspicious activity, you got to go intercept that and get in there. As we wrap things up here, because our time is up, Jim, I want to read one quote from the War Zone article that came out commenting about this Hudson piece. And this was back in January of this year, but the quote is here, by targeting aircraft sitting in the open, an adversary could well prevent them from ever entering the fight, even with limited attacks, such as ones involving weaponized commercial drones. So it's not like we've never thought about this before. And we just need to actually believe that it can happen and stop resting on our laurels as we move forward. Anyway, our time is up. Jim, thank you very much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Curtis.
Yep. Thank you, the listener, for joining us today. We wanted to make sure we talked about this Ukraine-Russian strategic attack with the UAVs and the drones. It is quite the game changer, not only in warfare, but in the diplomacy that goes along with conflict, and how that has now become a little bit more, I think, tricky. Anyway, we hope that you'll join us. Check us out on our website at thinkdeterrence.com. You can check us out on our podcasts on YouTube and Rumble, as well as anywhere you listen to podcasts, as well as read some of our pieces. I have a new article out today. Well, last week, as you're listening to today, on Global Security Review, talking about Air Force nuclear modernization. And as always, as you're driving home in the D.C. Traffic or wherever you may be listening to us, we want you to always remember to think deterrence.
Thanks, Bert.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.